Yara, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today at this particularly overwhelming and horrifying time for all of historical Palestine. That's also paralleled with these beautiful moments of reaffirmed agency and unity and of celebration of survival and Sumud. I'm really delighted to begin these conversations with you, and I want to briefly introduce you to everyone who is here and listening to us. Dr. Yara Hawari completed her PhD in Middle East politics at the University of Exeter in the UK, and is a Palestinian scholar, activist, writer, and political commentator based in Ramallah in the occupied Palestinian territories. She's also a senior analyst at Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, and she's about to publish her first novel, The Stone House, with Hajar Press, which I really hope I get a signed copy of, and I can't wait to read in the fall. Yara, as you know, When We Begin With Us is a series of conversations that are inspired by a fusion of my readings of Edward Said and Toni Morrison's writings. They revolve around Edward Said's reflections on the fact that everything we research, everything we write, the very analysis we're able to see or piece together on a particular topic is shaped by where we choose to place our point of beginning. And Toni Morrison's liberating assertion that no community or collective is in fact other, for we have always been imagining ourselves. We are the subjects of our own narrative and witnesses to and participants in our own experience. We are choices, and in my opinion, to begin with us, to be able to center ourselves, our history, our narratives, and our worldview as natural and self-evident, as opposed to marginal or controversial or violent, is a form of resistance. I know that in many of your interventions on Palestine in media outlets and news channels in the West in the past few weeks, your worldview has been sidelined as a controversial or marginal Palestinian perspective, as opposed to being the dominant self-evident perspective that it is in many parts of the world, as well as under international law. Can you tell us a little bit about this experience and about how you think knowledge and conversations about the political and about global solidarity can shift when we're allowed to begin with us and to choose our own worldviews and struggles as the natural order of things in the universe?
Shireen, it's a pleasure to be in conversation with you. I have to say it's a very odd experience. Being objects of such intense media coverage and academic scholarship, and essentially having to defend and prove our humanity at the same time, it's almost an ethereal experience. And sometimes I really find myself stepping outside my body and looking in. And I think it's not only because it's such a bizarre situation and such an abnormal situation, but also because it's a way for me to emotionally detach from what is happening, even for a brief moment. And this abnormality is reality. I have never known anything else. I have never known anything other than being Palestinian. Even in my time spent outside of Palestine, which was about a third of my life, that abnormality, I can't even say the word, that abnormality of being Palestinian is ever present. You know, sometimes I would dread when people ask me where I'm from, because as a Palestinian, you know, you often have to defend your identity and your very existence, or, you know, they demand an immediate 101 and what they call the conflict. And I think many people are not necessarily ill-meaning, but the exhaustion of having to describe your lived reality nearly every time you meet someone new really takes a toll. It takes a toll. And I think as well-meaning as people might be, they don't realize how emotionally evocative questions on our identity can be. And going back to this question of the Western media, I think there have been moments similar to the last few weeks where there's this sudden media flurry and everyone wants to talk to a Palestinian. But I think this time round it was more intense, and there have been more Palestinian, young, non-conventional Palestinian voices in the media. There was a demand for those voices, and that demand has come out of decades of work by Palestinians forcing themselves in these spaces and demanding to be heard. And the experience that I've had in the last few weeks has been mixed, really. much of it is, as you might expect, you know, ask questions that are sort of designed to trip us up and make us sound crazy or violent or unreasonable. But there were also moments that were surprising, like being asked on a mainstream US channel about ethnic cleansing and settler colonialism. A couple of times, this has happened actually a couple of times, and it agitated the hell out of me, was, you know, quantifying what I was saying as biased by the presenter. You know, I was told several times that, well, yes, but you're coming from a Palestinian perspective. And I didn't see that happen to any other commentator who wasn't Palestinian, particularly white men. No one ever says that to a white man on mainstream TV, that you're a white man and, you know, therefore obviously biased. And when this kind of thing happens, obviously I'm incredibly agitated, but it also reminds me very much of the words of Grada Colomba, who's a Portuguese artist and writer. And she wrote this excerpt that I want to read to you that I think is really speaks to this experience. She writes, "They place the discourses of black and people of color scholars back at the margins as deviating knowledge, while white discourses remain at the center as the norm. When they speak, it is scientific. When we speak, it is unscientific. When they speak, it is universal. When we speak, it is specific. When they speak, it is objective. When we speak, it is subjective. When they speak, it is neutral. When we speak, it is personal. When they speak, it is rational. When we speak, it is emotional. And when they speak, it is impartial. When we speak, it is partial. When they speak, it is that they have facts. And when we speak, it's that we have opinions. When they speak, it is that they have knowledge. When we speak, it is that we have experiences." And she writes that these are not simple semantic categorizations. They possess a dimension of power that maintains hierarchical positions. And we're not dealing here with the simple semantic, but rather with violent hierarchy, which defines who can speak. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is also reminiscent of what Edward Said wrote when he wrote Permission to Narrate following the Israeli invasion of Lebanon and the terrible media coverage of that invasion. And that idea as well, that to be emotional is to be biased or is to be problematic in discourse is also incredibly problematic. I had an experience where I was explaining the recent lynchings and pogroms of Palestinians and the fact that Israeli Jewish settler mobs were going round and marking Palestinian homes for them to attack later. And this was happening in places where my family live and my friends live. And it was a very difficult thing to convey. And I couldn't do it without emotion. No one can do that without emotion. You have to be incredibly robotic. And so you find yourself policing yourself, which I think is really a challenge, because on the one hand, you don't want to police yourself. You want to allow yourself to be real and your authentic self. But on the other hand, if you break down in a media interview, people are going to disregard everything you've said. So it continues to be a struggle to talk in these kinds of spaces.
I could not agree with that sentiment more, and it's going to make me jump to Hisham Matar right away and to something that I read that he wrote that really spoke to me. It's called Writing with the Horror. And as you know, Hisham Matar is a wonderful Libyan writer. And in it, he writes about how a writer from Syria asked him for his advice on how he finds it within himself to write at such a horrifying time for the region when she finds herself unable to write with what she described as the horror. And a little further in the piece, he also reflects, "I don't think people realize how hard things are for Arabs now and how hard they have been for a long time. I don't, for example, think people truly understand how horrible it has been to grow up watching Palestine being eaten away with each passing day. I don't think even we Arabs understand the full psychological effect it has had on us as a people, the despair and anger, the self-loathing. And I don't think we realize to what extent that long and drawn-out corrosion has distorted our politics." And this piece really stayed with me, I think partly because I'm also often unable to write with the horror, and that's something that's reflected in the highs and lows of my career. But really because I think this is a kind of trauma that I feel is rarely acknowledged in academia or in the politics of knowledge production. how horrible it is for us, really, as you just described, sometimes to emotionally, mentally, and physically write about the horror, and how often I've personally declined to and later sometimes regretted it. And another thing it made me reflect on was that when I do write about the horror in the context of Palestine, for example, I do it by doing what I think most of us do. I write about the horror by framing it within and magnifying the hope. I've been criticized in academia in the past for doing this, but for me, it's not only a political choice that I'm making, but a visceral human one. Hope keeps us alive as a collective, as Edward Said has written as well. And you're someone who, in my opinion, is not only able to write with the horror, but is able to be a multitasking powerhouse during the horror. And this is something I greatly, greatly admire about you. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how it feels for you to be able to do this for your collective during these crucial moments in your history, and about what drives you to do that as well, and where you find your inspiration. Mostly, like, whether or not you feel like the fact that you are often literally writing or speaking with the horror is acknowledged, you know, in academia, or, as we like to say, beyond.
Yeah, I read something recently about hyperactive multitasking as a way to relieve anxiety, and that's something that definitely I do. I see it in myself, but also among my peers. It's a way to deal with that anxiety, the trauma you immerse yourself in work and activism, so that you don't have time to process the events that are unfolding around you. And also at times like this, I think there's also an adrenaline kick that helps sort of, you know, that helps you through it. But honestly, Shireen, I'm a writer, and these last few weeks, I haven't written a single thing. I haven't written an article, despite the requests. I haven't, you know, apart from the, you know, tweeting sort of very factually about different violent things that were happening. I haven't written. I haven't been able to write. I've been speaking a lot, but I haven't been writing. And that I found particularly strange, because usually writing is an outlet for me. Although now that I'm saying that, I do realize that actually I just finished the first novel of my draft, so that is a form of writing. And perhaps my novel, without giving away too much, or my novella is about the period after the Nakba, and I was writing, and the things that I had written in there were being reiterated today. And I found that incredibly devastating to write about lynch mobs that my grandparents faced, only to be experiencing them on the streets here. I think there are just ups and downs. I think it's never consistent, my productivity. There are periods of high productivity and there are periods of low productivity, and I think that's probably the case for so many people. I think with regards to inspiration, I say this a lot and on repeat, but I genuinely mean it, but I take my inspiration from women, mostly from the Palestinian women that are around me, that who are constantly sidelined in meetings, in political meetings. They're constantly sidelined in the streets. They're sidelined and marginalized from institutional political spaces, and yet they continue to do the junkie work, the majority of the work in these grassroots mobilizing spaces, despite the fact that their comrades, their male comrades, are treating them in that way. And I find that so incredible. So for me, that's where I take my inspiration from.
I'm going to stay with this theme a little longer, the incredible women that inspire us and uplift us in these spaces, and add maybe a touch of Edward Said as an invitation to all of us to maybe reflect on the question of what the public intellectual looks like for us today. In Representations of the Intellectual, Edward Said voiced that there has been no revolution in modern history without intellectuals. Conversely, there has been no major counter-revolutionary movement without intellectuals. For Said, intellectuals have been the fathers and mothers of revolutions, and of course, sons and daughters, even nephews and nieces. Being in struggle with Palestine rising up yet again in this moment in our history, and reaffirming the unity of its people and their agency across geographic locations, I've been really inspired by the eruption of a new generation of radical feminist Palestinian scholar activists on the scene. a rising collective that, of course, you're a very active part of. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about these voices and about your experience as a scholar activist during this moment, and as well as an academic that is openly affiliated with a collective struggle for liberation in Palestine today.
I'm an academic who's openly affiliated with the Palestinian liberation struggle without a position in an academic institution. So that should tell you a lot. I have an honorary position. It's not easy, I think, being scholar activist or an academic immersed in a liberation struggle. I don't think it's supposed to be easy. That's why it's called struggle. I think for those who are actually within the academy, in a way, it's a lot worse, whose jobs and livelihoods, you know, are reliant on finding that work in the academy. I left the academy to work for an independent Palestinian organization, a think tank, and so I don't face the same pressures and scrutiny for my activism and being outspoken on Palestine as other colleagues and comrades might. And indeed, in the academy all around the world, I think it's being made incredibly hard to take a principled position on Palestine, both for faculty and for students. And even more challenging than that, the academy today remains complicit in the misuse of power through development of weapons, through dehumanizing narratives, through centering the victors' histories and erasing existences. And in general, I think scholarship and research is facing, and has been for quite some time, depoliticization. And this simultaneously coincides with the neoliberalization of the academy and the transformation of knowledge into a commodity. Political scholarship is seen as something negative. There is a strive for objectivity, which of course doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And it ignores the deeply political roots of the academy and knowledge production. And of course, many of those roots are incredibly dark. You know, knowledge and the pursuit of it was twisted in ways to enslave people, to colonize people. And so why is it only when we strive towards a more liberatory pedagogy that knowledge is brushed away as political? And perhaps, you know, it's pertinent here to say something about, you know, liberatory or critical pedagogy. You know, Paulo Freire writes that critical pedagogy is one that must be forged with and not for the oppressed. Mm. You know, making oppression objects of reflection by the oppressed is what he wrote, and meaning that, you know, we have to reframe that narrative so that they focus on these experiences of the oppressed. And in that, he's quite ambiguous about when he talks about who are the oppressed. And I think this is where things can get tricky, because oppressors themselves are incredibly apt at turning narratives on their head and making themselves out to be victims. And in the face of this, I think it's always useful to remind ourselves, what are the prevailing structures of power? Patriarchy, colonialism, white supremacy, capitalism, and identify those that it oppresses. And of course, these will always be entangled. And this also requires recalibration of, or rather a return to a lexicon where we have to use words such as liberty, justice, decolonization, and stop using words that, you know, talk about conflict resolution, state building. And I think, you know, I think that the question still remains, can you decolonize the academy? And this is amidst a flurry of, you know, efforts and programs that try to decolonize spaces within the academy. And I think it's important to create those spaces, but so that there can be more discussions like the one that we're having. But I think for me, the jury is still out on whether decolonization within the academy is even possible.
To kind of take you somewhere a little bit different, also to bring in another writer whose work I love and I think is very relevant to Palestine. In Between the World and Me, Ta-Nehisi Coates, who is writing a letter to his teenage son on the reality of being Black in America, writes to him, "Here is what I would like for you to know. In America, it is traditional to destroy the Black body. It is heritage. It is hard to face this, but all our phrasing, race relations, racial justice, racial profiling, white privilege, even white supremacy, serves to obscure that racism is a visceral experience, that it dislodges brains, blocks airways, rips muscle, cracks bones, You must never look away from this. You must always remember that the sociology, the history, the economics, all land with great violence upon the body. Angela Davis also said that to be born black in America is to be born in jail. And Ta-Nehisi Coates has written that not being violent enough could cost me my body. Being too violent could cost me my body. We could not get out. I want to kind of bring you a little bit to a conversation about global solidarity and ask first, does this tradition to destroy the body while denying you the right to resist its destruction speak to you as a Palestinian? And can you tell us a bit about your experiences as a collective in solidarity and struggle with Black Lives Matter, and whether it has empowered you both in ways you had not imagined, or maybe through histories of joint struggle you had not yet recovered?
Yeah, so not being violent enough could cost me my body, and being too violent could cost me my body. I think that speaks very much to the Palestinian reality in Palestine, of this choice of either resisting, which can have severe and violent consequences, or not resisting, and thus allowing for this slow but sure erasure of your people. And I think this is also the reality for a lot of people fighting injustice around the world. But I think perhaps maybe it resonates with me because Palestinians have also had this long connection with the black struggle in America and with various African liberation struggles. And so the alliance with BLM, Black Lives Matter, was and is not particularly surprising, especially considering the shared structures of oppression and the fact that we are victims of many of the same tools of violence, literally the same tools, the same weaponry, the same tear gas, the same skunk water, etc. But I think the ones forging that relationship at the moment really are the Palestinians in the diaspora, particularly in America, who are teaching us what better solidarity looks like, you know, a two-way solidarity looks like. And I think Palestinians also still have a lot to learn in that regard. I think our struggles have always empowered each other, you know, because of those similarities. But we also recognize differences, and we continue to learn from each other. For example, there was a call from our comrade in America not to use Palestinian Lives Matter as a slogan. And I think that's an important, an incredibly important point, not to appropriate a slogan of another struggle and to take away the intention and the importance of that struggle. And it's, you know, it's a learning process, and still a lot of people don't see the harm in that. But, you know, Palestinians, we have plenty of slogans. We don't need to take other people's to, you know, hammer home the violence that we are facing. Mm-hmm. And I think also these kinds of solidarity links force us to also have an internal reckoning with ourselves and to do self-reflection. For Palestinians, for example, our solidarity with Black Lives Matter necessitates that. We also have to look at anti-blackness within our own communities, which has a long and deep history. And so that's why these kinds of connections are important, because they insist and require on making the world a better place.
And on that beautiful note of maybe an insistence or an urgency to make the world a better place, I want to end by coming full circle and saying that despite the horror, the debilitating feeling of powerlessness and the pain and trauma of this moment, I've personally not felt this kind of shiver of hope, anxiety, and insomnia overtake my body since the Egyptian and Tunisian uprisings in 2011, or felt this much joy at seeing unity and agency erupt, in this case all over historic Palestine, against such terrifying odds, and despite or maybe because of the lack of any unified Palestinian political leadership on the scene. And I wanted to ask you how it feels for you to be in this moment, and maybe for your generation or our generation, as Palestine rises up with and around you and around me.
I mean, there are times where I have felt incredibly hopeful, and I think more recently I've been feeling a little bit deflated. But I would say the last few weeks there has been a shift and something, and everyone keeps saying it feels different. And I just think how many times our parents or grandparents have said that. But it does feel different. It feels different because of the unity that we're seeing, the fact that we're seeing Palestinians mobilize and rise up across their fragmented geographies. This has been, you know, a direct policy of the colonizers to fragment us and to divide us socially, politically, geographically. The last few weeks have been remarkable in showing that we are Palestinian and that we identify with each other's local struggles. You know, we rallied around Sheikh Jarrah, not because this is only happening in Sheikh Jarrah. Actually, no, ethnic cleansing and forced displacement is happening across colonized Palestine, across the so-called Green Line. But because we see that reiteration, we see in their struggle, our struggles, our parents' struggles, our grandparents' struggles, our neighbors' struggles, that is how we were able to mobilize around this small neighborhood in Jerusalem. And also the fact that the Palestinian citizens of Israel, in all their glory, are raising the Palestinian flag, which is not as easy as you might think. It's actually can, you know, land you jail time to do that. It's considered, you know, a political act, one, you know, supporting a enemy or a terrorist group to raise a Palestinian flag in Israel. So the fact that Palestinian citizens have been doing this and been doing so with pride is beautiful to see. But then this has all been overshadowed, of course, by the horrific bombardment of Gaza. So, you know, on the one hand, we have this beautiful mobilization of really grassroots mobilization by the youth, disregarding completely the leadership. The Palestinian Authority has been totally absent in all of this, and so they should stay. But this has been overshadowed by, of course, the devastation in Gaza. And something, though, that I do take from Gaza and speaking to friends there is that they said to me, you know, this time we also thought it was different. We, despite the fact that we were the only ones being bombed, we didn't feel alone. And I think that makes me feel incredibly emotional and happy, because they shouldn't be alone. And yet Israel has, you know, succeeded so much in making them feel like they're not a part of Palestine. Gaza's never referred to as Palestine anymore. It's simply Gaza. And people in Gaza are Gazans, not Palestinians. But Gaza has become the linchpin of Palestine, as my friend Tariq Makwani would say. It is Palestine.
Yara, thank you so much. It's always, always a pleasure to be in conversation with you and an inspiration. And I can't think of better words than those of Tariq to leave everyone with today. And thank you again for sharing your thoughts and experiences with us today with such generosity and such grace. Until next time, when I hope we can finally meet in person and have a very different and much more hopeful conversation about liberation.